This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So this is the kind of result that football fans in New England have come to expect. 38. Snap. Ball down. Kick up.
Kick is on the way. Kick is good. The kick is good. Adam Vinatieri from 41 yards out. After winning the Super Bowl in 2002, that kick made the New England Patriots champions again in 2004, and they did it again the following year.
In the last 10 years, the Patriots have made it to the Super Bowl four times, winning three championships. On Sunday, they'll try to make it number four against the New York Giants. But whatever the outcome, the Pats will continue to be one of the NFL's most elite and successful teams. Win or lose, they'll still have their flashy stadium, one of the league's best quarterbacks, and a growing and devoted fan base.
And of course, it hasn't always been so. In fact, there are plenty of us around who remember when the Patriots were a bit of a joke, or at best, a scruffy group of football upstarts without even a stadium to call their own. And here to talk a little bit about New England football history and the extraordinary transformation of this franchise is Richard Johnson. He's curator of the Sports Museum of Boston. And Richard Johnson, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So it wasn't long ago, 1960, when the Boston Patriots were a brand new team, charter members of the new American Football League. And here's how the New York Times recently described them. Those early Patriots were unheralded nomads, more like a traveling circus that won games by hook or crook on a shoestring budget. So how different was that team than the one that will take the field in Indianapolis on Sunday?
It's like comparing a Conestoga wagon to a space shuttle. That would be one way to describe it, or maybe the Mayflower to the QE2. It's an enormous difference because what's happened is the Crafts have transformed the Patriots from a also-ran, almost-forgotten franchise into the model of a business school case study merged with a football juggernaut.
And I want to talk about what Bob Kraft brought to the Patriots. But first, let's go back and talk a little about this history because it's so interesting. Remind us of that first Patriot team or those early Patriot teams. Who owned it? What did it take? First of all, what did it take to become a member of the then upstart American Football League?
Well, you give credit to Billy Sullivan and his family because they were the last owners. They were the last team in the American Football League. They were the last club to pay the $25,000 initiation fee to join the club. And to do that, and I spoke with him years ago about this, he claimed he even broke his children's piggy banks to get some of the money to pay this fee. He called his uncle, who owned a printing company in Lowell, who printed the programs for the games. He helped. Other members of his family helped, and they scrapped together the 25 grand, which today might buy you a luxury suite for a game. I'm not sure whether shrimp would be included or not.
Right.
So the origins of this team are as humble as that of any pro team in the country.
Now, listeners, we're talking about the extraordinary transformation of a local sports franchise from lovable underdogs to one of the NFL's glamour teams. What do you remember about those old Boston Patriots? And why do you think it took so long for football to catch on in this part of the world? And we're going to talk about that in a moment. I'm with Richard Johnson. He's curator of the Sports Museum of Boston. You can join us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Richard Johnson, back then, the Patriots didn't even have their own home field. They sort of struggled to find a home, sort of like wandering football nomads. Tell us about that effort to find a place to play.
Well, here's a description of their story during those years. In their first 10 years, they played home games, quote-unquote home games, in seven stadiums in three states.
In three states.
Yes, because in 1967, they played a home game that would have been against the Chargers in San Diego because of the World Series the Red Sox were playing. No one expected the Red Sox to win the American League Championship that year. So that game was moved to San Diego. And then in 1965, they played a home game in Birmingham, Alabama against the New York Jets because of Joe Namath being the big hometown star in Alabama, having been the Alabama quarterback prior to joining the AFL. So they played in seven stadiums in three states in their first 10 years. It makes your head spin.
And when they played around here, what they played at the Harvard Stadium, they played at BU, they played at BC, and they played at Fenway Park, as you just mentioned, right?
They started at BU on September 9th, 1960, about 300 yards from where we're sitting right now. They played their very first game on a Friday night, the first game in AFL history. They then moved to Fenway Park in 1963, played there until 1968. Then Boston College for 1 year, where I went to my first game back in 1969. Harvard Stadium in 1970, and then down the road to Foxborough.
That's amazing. Why did it take so long to get a stadium? Was this typical of a young sort of upstart team to be kind of rootless and homeless like this?
Well, it's the confluence of many things. One was the checkered history of pro football in Boston. There had been four teams that had preceded the Patriots that had played Major League pro football.
See, this is interesting. I just learned this today. Yeah. Tell me about those teams.
Three NFL clubs and one club in the first version of the old AFL. So we had the Bulldogs in 1928, the Redskins from 1932 through 36. The Yanks,
imagine. Now, the Redskins, wait, stop with the Redskins, because they were called the Braves, am I right?
They were called the Braves at first, and then because they didn't pay all their rent at Braves Field, they moved to Fenway Park in 1933, played there through the 36th season, actually were the only club in NFL history to play a home playoff game on the road. They moved their playoff game to New York because their owner was so incensed at the lack of support in Boston, he moved them before they'd even change their name. That's pretty weird.
That's amazing.
Then we had a team called the Yanks. Imagine a team playing at Fenway Park called the Yanks. In the National Football League from 1944 through 1948, that team became the Baltimore and now Indianapolis Colts. So I'm surprised there isn't a scenario by which the Patriots are playing themselves. That's the only thing that hasn't happened yet.
Eventually, though, they're pretty well received around here, the early Boston Patriots. They earned a reputation as a colorful group of athletes who could find ways to win in surprising ways, right?
Well, you know what's interesting about those early teams? The 1963 team had a wonderful chance to win the AFL championship. They traveled to San Diego, and shades of Spygate, when they went out there, Sid Gilman, the San Diego Chargers coach, had arranged for a training facility for them at a naval base. And wouldn't you know it, that a number of the employees there wearing naval uniforms and carrying clipboards were actually Charger scouts, Charger employees, stealing their plays.
Oh, wow.
And a few years ago, I did a story for the Globe about this game, and I talked to Gino Cappelletti, and he said, "It was as if they knew our plays." And I said, "Gino, I just read a story. They did know your plays." So there was a far more egregious version of Spygate before Spygate, and it was the Patriots who were the victims.
We never heard that as an excuse for Spygate from Bill Belichick or anybody else, though. They did it to us first.
What was interesting about that year was the Chargers were a wonderful team. They probably would have had a great chance to beat the Bears, the NFL champions that year. It didn't happen, but the Patriots more than held their own. In fact, their one loss record at Fenway Park, I believe, is second only to their one lost record at Gillette Stadium. So they had great years at Fenway.
Listeners, we're talking about this great transformation of the Boston Patriots from lovable underdogs to one of the NFL's glamour teams. They become, of course, the New England Patriots on their way to the Super Bowl on Sunday. What do you remember about those early Boston Patriots, and why do you think it took so long for football to sort of catch hold in this part of the country? I'm here with Richard Johnson. He's curator of the Sports Museum of Boston. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Richard, there are a number of great anecdotes about this old team that I love. In one of the earliest games, apparently a fan runs into the end zone and swats away what would have been a winning touchdown pass by the opposing team and then vanished into the crowd. The Patriots won, and to this day, nobody knows who that fan was.
There were rumors for years that it was team owner Billy Sullivan in a trench coat.
I love that.
And he never disputed that. He never claimed the honor of having done that, but he never denied it either.
That's interesting. What do you think?
Do
we have film of this?
There is film of it. In fact, there is film that we discovered at the Sports Museum that the Patriots now have, which shows the culprit coming out of the crowd and knocking the pass away. It's quite remarkable.
And then I'm just trying to picture this. So the guy jumps out of the crowd, swats the pass away, and then the game is essentially officially over, right?
And he blends back into the crowd.
And then the crowd sort of swarms the field.
They swarm the field. Victory has been sealed, and the mystery remains.
Also, another story about the stands. At one point, I'm not sure where this happened, actually catching fire.
Yeah, at a preseason game at Boston College, and the stands caught fire. People continued to watch the game. Then at a certain point, they had to vacate the stands. So the players and fans congregated in the middle of the field while the fire department came and put the fire out, and then they played the rest of the game.
That's very funny.
It's just bizarre.
Now, Richard, I understand you grew up in Worcester. Do you have your own recollections about what it was like to root for the Patriots back then?
Oh, do I ever. My dad brought several friends and I to our very first game at Boston College in 1969, a game against the Dolphins, and it's one of those events that is an eBay-proof event because the rains were so torrential that day. Any collectibles from that game, whether it be a ticket stub or a program, are non-existent because they were swept away. And if there were 4,000 people in the stands that day, I'd be surprised. But we toughed it out, and we sat through the entire game. The Dolphins won 7-6, and I remember distinctly the sports cartoon in the paper the next day showed the Dolphins swimming in the end zone, and one of their great backs, either Kick or Zonka, scored the winning touchdown, and they got an extra point. And I forget to this day whether the Patriots scored two field goals or whether they had a touchdown and missed the point after. I think it was two field goals by Geno. But again, I feel sort of I know the sort of the DNA of this team from the ground up, because having been there at an AFL game back in the day with only several thousand people, having seen it with my own eyes, I find the heights to which the team has risen now to be almost unimaginable. I mean, anyone that remembers those days has to just stand back in awe and, you know, sort of stare at the edifice that has been created by the crafts and by the alumni of the team. One of the comforting things about the Patriots is that on Sunday we'll turn the volume down on the television broadcast and listen to Gino Cappelletti, the original Boston Patriot, and Gil Santos broadcast the game. And just hearing Gino's voice means all is well with the world and all is well with the Patriots. He is such a beloved figure and probably the most deserving figure in pro football not enshrined in the Hall of Fame in Canton. He's very deserving of that honor.
Richard, give us a sense. I want to come back to this point. We talked about those early pre-Patriot teams, the Bulldogs, the Braves, the Redskins, and the Yanks even. This is such a sports-crazy city and region of the country. Why did it take so long for professional football to take root here and grow in this way?
You know, it's interesting. I think it was because there was enough college football here to satisfy people. Certainly when the Redskins were playing in the 30s, there were many people that remembered that Harvard had won the Rose Bowl only 13, 14 years earlier. Boston College had become a powerhouse. Boston University would become a powerhouse, especially when Harry Aganis arrived in 1948. And the landscape, this was a small city at that point, you know, so that even though we were very big in other sports, the landscape was really more a college football one than a pro football, you know, hotbed. And that, of course, has now changed to a great degree. But back in the day, you would get a larger crowd for a Boston College game at Fenway Park than you would for a Yanks game, for example.
Quite a transformation. Listeners, if you've got questions for Richard Johnson, curator of the Sports Museum of Boston, about these early days of the Patriots, you can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Another interesting detail that I wanted to ask you about, of course, the Patriots going to the Super Bowl on Sunday against the New York Giants. Before the Patriots, the Giants would actually play here from time to time. So lots of New Englanders rooted for them then, and I gather some still do.
Well, the Giants have always had a very large following in New England because for those 12 years between 48 and 60, we didn't have a pro team here. The Giants were an ascending NFL team. They got really good in the late 50s and early 60s and were, in fact, a championship team in the days of Frank Gifford and Kyle Rote and Sam Huff. And those teams captivated the area. So the traditional Sunday afternoon in New England during the autumn, during that time, during the Eisenhower years, was the 1 o'clock game coming from Yankee Stadium or the Polo Grounds with the Giants. And so there's a whole generation of supporters of the Giants from New England. In fact, I know people who have season tickets to the Red Sox and the football Giants. And I don't think there is any other franchise combination in the country that includes teams with two rival cities and, you know, sort of has that same combination, you know.
Fascinating. So bring us forward to the current owner, Robert Kraft, and how much his involvement with the team led to its current success. First of all, in 1994, he was willing to pay what was then regarded as huge money for the team, $175 million.
And roughly, yeah.
Roughly. How big? I mean, that was, even his wife, Maya Kraft, thought he was nuts shelling out that kind of money, right?
Yeah, in fact, he loves to tell a story on really that she, his most trusted advisor, thought he had flipped his lid when he paid that much for the team. But you know what? It ended up being a little bit like buying Berkshire Hathaway stock 30 years ago. It's paid off in so many ways. And one of the prime motivating forces for the purchase was the fact that Bob Kraft had attended games with his kids for years. He was a season ticket holder. He had suffered through the long afternoons on those cold aluminum seats and wanted to turn things around, but make it a family venture. So it was really a project undertaken with the idea that it becomes something he share with his family. And has he ever, and he's included all of us for the ride. It's been such a delightful stewardship of this club. And such an improbable story.
Pretty good investment. He shelled out $175 million, and according to Forbes magazine, the value of the franchise has increased by over $1 billion. Not bad.
Not bad.
Okay, let's take a couple of calls. We've got some people standing by. Roy is calling from Coventry, Rhode Island. Hi, Roy.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Enjoy your program always, and especially this.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask, and thank God this happened, what prevented the Patriots from moving to Hartford?
Great question. Yeah, that was a few years ago. I mean, more than a few years ago, almost a decade ago.
Yeah,
or so.
I remember they had looked at Hartford. No, I think it was basically a strategy to get some leverage. You know, there was also the thought that the team might possibly get a parcel of property down near the Gillette plant in South Boston near the Postal Annex. And that didn't happen. But, I think as a strategy, it was really an attempt to get the leverage to allow them to build the stadium and get the infrastructure help that allowed them to do everything that has been done there. So
an interesting thing about that story, though, because I remember covering this briefly for NPR. I know people are saying that Kraft never intended to take the team to Hartford, that he was, as you say, looking for leverage. But boy, Governor John Rowland, then of Connecticut, sure was counting on it. He took it really seriously and thought that they were going to really get the Patriots down there to Hartford.
Well, there isn't anything to say that it might not have happened, but I think that an owner who cited as one of his prime reasons for buying the team the departure of the Boston Braves in 1953, I think had to think twice, three, four times before he would be known as the man that moved the Patriots from the state of Massachusetts. Mm. And even though they have a New England appellation, it just isn't the same.
Well, clearly a smart businessman. Very quickly, in just a few seconds that remain, he's proved himself to be a pretty smart football guy as well, bringing in people like Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Richard Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank
you. We appreciate you coming in and telling us stories about the old Patriots and what a ride it's been for them. That's Richard Johnson. He's curator of the Sports Museum of Boston. And listeners, you can continue the conversation at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Jennifer Getzinger, from BU to directing the wildly popular TV series Mad Men. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.